part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part. Fanboy.com.
Well, shall we begin our interview?
Sure, let's do that.
Let's just get rid of the side chat, the small talk, shall we? Let's talk about what we're here to talk about. Let's begin by saying that this is the Part-Time Fanboy podcast. My name is Christian Horn. I have a very special guest on the line. His name is David A. Rodriguez. And you are the writer, the creator of a comic, a graphic novel called Finding Gossamer, right? Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yeah, I think that's an acceptable pronunciation. Gossamer is normally the regular one, but like because of the Y, you can throw that mirror in there.
I almost said like mirror, and then I was like, I'll just stick with God. I'll be safe. So I didn't know which way to go, but it can
be. You're good.
Are we talking tomato, tomato?
Yeah, pretty much.
Great.
It'll answer either.
Oh, yeah, no. And this book is coming out from Third World Studios at the end of March, correct?
That is the targeted date, yes.
Everyone's target dates are all over the place, but we're looking at end of March for Finding Gossamer or Gossamer, however you want to pronounce it, tomato, tomato. And you're pretty much, you're the writer, the creator on this book, correct?
Yes, I do have, I like to say like I originated it, but like really Sarah is essentially a co-creator on the book as far as like her building the world visually around the, you know, the narrative that I did for it. So co-created essentially.
Gotcha. And Sarah is the artist, correct?
Yes, she does all the art. Sarah Ellerton.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the art is gorgeous. It's like this beautiful painted sort of, you know, I'm not minimizing it by saying like cartoonish or animation style. I mean, I think that a lot of people use that term to minimize certain art, but that I'm not doing that in this case. It is some really, really beautiful, gorgeous stuff. I cannot say that emphatically enough, loudly enough. You know, you should be proud of the way that this book looks, and you should also be proud of the story as well, because it's a sort of like very unique take on something like the Narnia books or something like that. Correct?
Yeah. Thank you, Christian. I appreciate that a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, why don't you go into a little bit of what, you know, the quote unquote, I always say to everyone, what's the elevator pitch for Finding Gossamer? What would you like people to know off the bat about the book itself?
So for me, Finding Gossamer, when I was, let's see if we're going to elevator pitch it. So the elevator pitch is, it is about a young girl who is taking care of her younger brother, a character who is on the autism spectrum, and he is testing to get into a prestigious academy so that she can kind of not have to take care of him anymore and move on with her life.
Sure.
And instead of getting into the academy, he solves, to get into the academy, you have to, you know, try to solve this unsolvable equation.
Yeah.
And he sees that by solving it, it is actually sends them into a magical realm where all the magic there is done by science and math. And so he has incredible power there, which makes him a target. And so the brother and sister are working out their complicated relationship against the backdrop of like a fantasy world that is in turmoil.
Yeah. No, I mean, that works. I mean, that explains it. I mean, pretty much like in a nutshell. But the thing, the sort of like twist on this a little bit is the fact that magic is sort of like mathematically based, correct?
Correct.
In this world. And because of the fact that he is sort of a like math prodigy, I would say, right?
Yes. So his prodigy status is a little more specific in that he can solve essentially any like problem that is put in front of him, but he's not like an applied mathematician in that sense. Like he can't theorize, and he doesn't come up with those things. He just can't not solve problems.
Sure. Sure.
And so, yeah. And so that is.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, it's basically, I guess what I'm trying to figure out as far as, and how to explain it. I mean, it opens up with him sort of being, or the sister trying to get him into this special school.
Right.
And there's a whole scene or framework where he's given part of how he gets into this school, or how kids get into the school, is they have to solve an equation, right?
Correct.
And the sister basically is saying in the admissions office to this very sort of like snooty, you know, yes. administrator, right? that he can solve anything. And yes. you know, they're kind of poo-pooing it, and they're sort of saying, you know, and it goes back and forth between her being in the admissions office and the brother being in the classroom or the testing room. Mm-hmm. And basically what I really liked about this was, at least the opening sort of like intro, was that he could solve it, but there's a part of him that feels like he's, that the world or the instructor that he's dealing with shouldn't have it solved for them, right? Like it's right. kind of like too big an equation for people to possess. Am I hitting that right?
Yeah. So what happens is when he starts to solve it, it gives him essentially a vision of its creation. And so he sees that it was not meant to be solved.
Yeah.
And that by solving it, it is putting worlds in danger, or something in danger. And the problem for him is that it's too big for him to even explain. And because he's younger, and because they both like desperately want these answers done, like they ignore his warnings about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And of course, as is the case in all drama, nobody listens to the smart person in the room. Well, right. not even drama, in real life.
Yes.
You know, there is precedence for this in the real world, unfortunately, that we're going
yes.
through. It sort of like leads to them traveling to this magical world, correct?
Correct. So he does eventually solve it.
Yeah.
Spoiler. Because yes, he does solve it, or else they'll never get there.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
he solves it, but in the exchange, he sort of tries to minimize what the damage will be by opening it and just trying to do what he thinks he can do to make his sister's life better and to do what she is asking him to do.
Sure. 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 Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's funny because I do really like the way you approached the book, and particularly the relationship between the brother and the sister, because, I mean, there is very much that... I mean, this book is very much aimed towards like the YA set a little bit, right? But at the same
right.
time, you're very much dealing with a very grown-up situation, which is somebody who loves their sibling, but doesn't feel like they can provide the services or needs for that sibling. And also, you know, because she's younger, there's a little bit of a selfish aspect, right? Which is like, hey, I want to live my life too, correct? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. So we don't dwell out in a lot in the book, but there's a lot of like sort of, we try to do like some environmental storytelling. So like you see when she's in her, like the small apartment that she shares with her brother, that there's bills piling up. She's not getting support from their parents.
Yeah.
And she has dreams of, you know, studying in Sydney. She wants to be a veterinarian. And, you know, she's done some work around that. And because of the choices that she's making and to choose to help her brother, she's not able to go do those things. Like she is, she feels like she's stuck.
Yeah.
And so I think in her mind, she sees this as a win-win for everyone. Like he gets to be where he can, you know, in her mind, where he can be taken care of, and then she can go on and like pursue her life.
Yeah.
And so it is coming from, it is a selfish place. But I think it's one that people who have been in that situation could empathize with and see why at, you know, being like a 19, 20 year old girl raising a 9 year old on his own. And then he has his own like special needs that go along with it. Like that can just, you could see why somebody would want to do that.
Yeah. Can you talk to me a little bit about sort of the, not to focus too much on it because I don't want to make that the center of the sort of book, but I mean the autism or the character on the spectrum sort of thing.
Yeah.
Do you have experience with that? How much research did you have to do?
So growing up, I lived with my nephew.
Okay.
Who is on the spectrum. Okay. And watching him, and so like living with him for a few years, and just like the, like the behaviors and the habits, and watching like how my aunt dealt with him, and like how they raised him and how they managed like his schedule and all of those things. And then when my own son was born, he has a lot of the same behaviors and tendencies as he did growing up. And so like a lot of those, like, so Denny is essentially a blend of my nephew and my son.
Gotcha.
And those sort of like the same like adherence to schedule and the needs for like the repetition and the collection and all of the things and the difficulties of dealing with that sort of disruption, where it's kind of blended into the book. And then also there was, you know, like books and research and advisors that I spoke with about making sure that we were doing a good representation of like a character on the spectrum and how sure. they would kind of deal with these situations and, you know, how people also treat those like people on the spectrum. And so that's what we were trying to accomplish in the book.
Yeah. No, I mean, you, I mean, from my understanding, I don't necessarily have a lot of experience, direct experience with people sort of on the spectrum. And it's interesting how in the past several years with just awareness exploding of just all kinds of, you know, different people, how many people have sort of become sensitive to the subject and sensitive to how characters are sort of portrayed in different media. I mean, I know there's a lot of like TV shows where it's like, I think there's one called like The Good Doctor or something.
The Good Doctor.
Yeah. Yep. Where there, it's interesting because there's people in, you know, whatever social media verse or what people who talk about things where it seems like one side is like, oh, this isn't the way it should be presented. And then there's another side that is, you know, oh, we should have this sort of open, you know, in our media so that people can know that this exists. Can you talk about right. like walking the balance between that like sensitivity or?
So for me, so the like Gossamer was first released like 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the other thing I wanted to ask.
And
about.
So when it came out, we were also in a different space.
Sure. Absolutely.
Than we are today. And so when the book came out for me, it was really more about wanting my son, my nephew, and people like them to just have a hero of their own.
Sure.
Because I feel like that's just, there's not enough of that around at the time. And then over the last 10 years, it has become like more set in popular culture where you see representations and like any Hollywood representation of any complex condition, it is like some people are going to like that there's representation at all, even if they're missing the mark, and others might not like whether they're presenting like, because it is a true fact is that a lot of times it is presented as somebody who is more of a prodigy being represented in those stories. And so that is one of the things that we try to, it is a big part of the beginning of the book, but that isn't what the book is about. Sure. And so that's what I try to do is like not make it a book that is entirely dependent on the prodigy nature of like Denny's behaviors and things like that. We wanted that to be an aspect of it, but really I wanted the book to be about the relationship between the brother and the sister.
Yeah. 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 Which I mean, you very much succeed at in this book.
Thank you.
The other thing I mean, I just need to ask you as an artist and as a creative person, What about the math aspect of this? Are you a math head? Or
I am
you,
not.
You're not at all?
I am the worst. Like, I barely passed
you and
like
me
algebra.
Both, brother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so two parts of it for me were, there was a quote that always that got me. I'm going to make sure I reference it properly. Give me 1 second so I do it. But there was a quote from an author that I am going to make sure I do
justice
properly here.
That's fine.
Here we go. So yeah, Arthur C. Clarke.
Okay.
Said, and I read this quote before I started working on Gossamer, and it was, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Yeah. Okay.
And so there was that part. And then there was just the part of the idea of math. So I think math is amazing. I think it's cool. And there's these things, like I took a class in college where they were talking about how math is essentially everything, right? Like, yeah, it is, it's what the universe is built on. And so like those two pieces kind of came together in my head, and where I was thinking of this world where, like, what if, like, the things we look at as technology and, you know, mathematical formulas and all of those other things, what if there was a world where that was just how they did their magic, essentially? Yeah. And so in Gossamer, they still have to solve the equation for, like, the chemical equation for, like, a fireball. Like, what does that look like? And so I worked with John Day, who was our math advisor on the book.
Yeah.
He's a friend of mine.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so he actually wrote a theoretical version of what that would look like. Like, what does the chemical, like, how would you make a fireball? So, like, you have the combustion aspect, you have the velocity, you know, geometry part of it. And so he wrote that out. And so when you see the arithmancer, like, project the formula, that's what it is. It's not like gibberish. Like, he wrote that down.
That's cool.
And we built, like, a fireball spell essentially out of math. And I just thought that was just a really cool hook for a world where you have a world where the most powerful people are the people who are, you know, best at math and science, which is something that, like, in our world,
they are in this world.
I know they are, but, like, we don't treat them that way.
You know what I mean?
And so, like, you have a world where, like, the smartest people, you, like, not just the smartest people, like, the smartest mentally, like, flexible people also are the ones who are the most powerful, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're your scholars and your theorists and, like, all of these other things. And so we also work that into other character classes, so to speak. So, like, there's, if you, like, break down the RPG rules for the characters, like, even the bladeslingers who are, like, using magic to, like, throw their swords and the swords come back, they have to have, like, basic understandings of geometry and velocity and those sorts of things. Like, there's no just magic for magic's sake. Like, even the warriors who want to do more things have to know some math in order to pull off their abilities and things like that. And there's, like, a character called the Calculator who has essentially a math bow who can shoot, like, multiple arrows that go off in different directions and do things. And so we just kind of want to make it the backbone of the world. And I just thought that would be a way to make this world, like, special and more reflective of the characters themselves. You know what I mean?
Well, I was wondering before I actually read the book and got the description in my inbox, you know, about what it was about. I was like, oh, is this sort of like a Danica McKellar thing where people are trying to get, like, young kids to sort of, like, dig math, like, through this book? But having read it, I mean, it is sort of like, you know, the backbone of this world that they go to. But it doesn't seem like that's something that you're trying to do, because, I mean, you know, part of your tagline is, like, math is magic, right? And me as a kid might look at that and be like, oh boy. Like, you know what I mean? Like, like, and because I was terrible at math and, and, just not very good. And it's funny, as I've gotten older and had my own daughter and, you know, she's, my daughter is not a big fan of math at all, but she's incredibly good at it, but she hates doing it. And I'm like, or being in class and study. And I'm just like, wow, I wish I had been like that, because I hated it and I sucked at it. Like, you know what I mean? So, I mean, for me, I mean, that's not what you're going for though, right? Is, like, purely an educational, but the backbone of your world is based in that. So it, in a way, it's kind of like sneaking it in the back door, right?
Right. Like it'd be like, I am very happy if anybody reads the book and they're like, oh, like this is like math is cool here.
Yeah.
Like that would be a great takeaway for the book. But yeah, I don't think I was going along the edutainment route. But it's always nice at a convention. Like, especially when we do gaming conventions, they love the concept because like, they're just like, oh, they love numbers. Or there's a large audience of people there who just love the idea of numbers and a world where, you know, knowing math and statistics and doing those things would make you badass. Like that is a sort of aspirational quality that I didn't think about when I made it, but I thought it was a nice side effect. Sure. Of kind of like how the book came out.
Sure. I mean, but when you think about it, wouldn't the basic concept of like magic, I mean, you have to study spells and you have to sort of like do equations and mix potions and things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's generally is kind of like math, right? Whatever right. alchemy is. I mean, I would imagine, I don't know. I'm not a magician. My name is right. not Gandalf. You know, I don't know, but it seems to me like that would be the backbone of it anyway, right? Like Dungeons yeah. and Dragons.
And that's kind of how that quote stuck to me, because if you look at how magic works in Dungeons and Dragons or the other things, if it was somebody from a less advanced culture looking at that, is that technology or is that magic? Or if somebody looked at the way we, like, if somebody looked at our technology, would they assume that, you know, we had to tell them like, yeah, we made a, like this piece of metal can retain knowledge and, you know, we can use it to transfer information anywhere across the planet. They're like, yeah, that's just sorcery. Like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
But, yeah. yeah.
And so that's kind of the idea of it for me is like, yeah, this like magic has rules. Magic has like, you have to study, you have to do the things, but kind of applying that to like math and science and that sort of thing. Like that was the fun part for me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, what's kind of cool about that in a way too, is that it would, in a way, make magic accessible to anyone, because one of the things that I've learned, particularly in trying to help like my daughter with homework and stuff like that, mm-hmm. is, I mean, my father was a chemical engineer and my father-in-law is like a sociologist, and, you know, mm-hmm. they're both have doc, you know, they had doctorates and, you know, much smarter than I will ever be and stuff like that. But, you know, those genes are kind of like in my system. And one of the things that my wife has always said to me is like, you were just always taught it wrong. And it would be amazing to me sometimes when I was like, okay, I suck at math, I'm going to try and sit down and help you solve this, where I would be able to figure it out. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, mentioning Danica McKellar again for the second time in this, probably the only time I've ever mentioned her on this podcast, is that there's you know, there's ways to approach learning that I mean, I don't know how old you are, but I was definitely not exposed to. Whereas now that I'm older, I'm like, yeah, I was taught wrong. Like,
yeah.
Like, what the fuck? You know what I mean? Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree. And for me, math, there was always the part of math where they're like, okay, go up to the board and show everybody how stupid you are at algebra. And I'm like, this is not helping me
get
better
started
at algebra. Like, I do not, like, I don't understand. Like, I could, my brain would not process how they were teaching me the transposing of, like, I'm bad at chemistry, I'm bad at algebra. Like, the concept, it's why I'm not a coder. Like,
I can't
code and I can barely script. Like, those are the, like, the levels of things. And something about the way either it is shown to me or the way my brain processes information, it just fights it very hard. Now I can keep track of like 7 fictional worlds at a time in my brain, but I cannot pull the math stuff together. And in Gossamer, I think that's actually a direct question that Jenna asks, is like, can anybody do magic here? And he's like, yeah, essentially, if you can do the math, you can do it. But just like in our world, there's the math that you and I can do, and then there's the math that changes the world. And like, that is the, you know, the wide spectrum of talent here, in the same way that it would be there, is like, yes, we can do magic at many, many levels, but like, even It hasn't been shown yet in the books, but like, for example, the idea of being able to project your theorem and solving it in the air is like a higher level thing. Like most people have to do it on paper. Gotcha, so if you're doing it in the air, like it's like you're doing math in your head.
Yeah.
And so they're doing that level of math in their head. And it's like, oh, I need to write this down or I won't be able to keep track of it in that sense. And so,
or God forbid, I have to do it on my fingers in front of
yes.
me. One, two, you know, three. Two. Well, so, I mean, talk to me about, because I mean, in my mind, I would never, my views toward, my disdain towards math, mostly because I was taught it incorrectly. I would never be like, I'm going to create a story where the backbone is kind of math. Not like, obviously you're not doing like an educational, you know, right. comic and stuff like that. But I mean, the backbone is math. So for somebody who is not like, I mean, I don't know, maybe your parents were scientists. Like, I don't know, like, or who has that sort of like background of loving math. What, how did that crack in your brain? Because usually most people who are creative that I've come across, they sort of like drift towards the thing that they're passionate about, right?
Right.
And obviously fantasy, I mean, you've mentioned role-playing games, which I'm a big fan of as well, like, you know, pencil and paper and all that stuff. And obviously there's a fantasy aspect and the art here is very, you know, very fantastical and beautiful and, you know, light and, you know, magical, mm-hmm. for lack of a better term. But for you, when you're starting to create a story, I mean, mm-hmm. was your son mathematically inclined, like the child in this book? Or?
He's better at math than I am, okay. but he's not mathematically inclined. And so for me, it's hard to say like what drew me to it other than while I'm not good at math, I think it's amazing. And I guess to me, that level of math always seemed like impossible or like magic in a way to me.
Yeah.
And so like, that's kind of my end to the story. Like I'm way more, so in this story, I'm way more Jenna than anybody else.
Sure.
And so like, I didn't know at the time, but like later, my wife and one of my friends were pointing out, they're like, well, that's just you and your brother. Like my brother came to live with me when I was 20.
Okay.
And he was 15 years old. And so for, you know, like I took care of my brother at that age. And so like
wow.
this story, like part of this story is me working through that and like what that means. And so, like, that's the emotional part of the story for me. And then the math was like something that I thought, like came to me because of that quote and because of like things that I had seen and just how amazing I always thought those sorts of stories were about people who can do that kind of math, is just always been like something I wish I could do, but I can't.
Sure.
Like at that level of prodigy. And then the other part was like growing up, my favorite stories were those kind of somebody from our world being pulled into a magical world.
Yeah.
And them being able to sort of have their own abilities that drive them through the story. And so like Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, there was like there was one, I'm trying to remember, there was like an animated series where they like went under the stairs, like the magical world of Og. Is that the one?
I don't know.
That one. And then growing up with my son, we would watch Dragon Tales. And there was just so many of those stories. And then, but wanting to do one that met, that also like, and this is not to say anything, like those stories did the same thing, but like also the Chronicles of Prydain are these fantastic stories that are classified as like middle-age reader or YA, but they have, so they're safe for kids to read, but they have such like mature themes
sure.
and like strong emotional backbones that I just like, those are the kind of stories I wanted to tell. And so like Gossamer was that story for me.
Yeah. It's just fascinating to me. I mean, I really love the idea that, you know, this whole math is magic and there's an underlying power that lies within that, because obviously, you know, that's how we split the atom and, you know, all mm-hmm. that stuff. But I just am fascinated by the aspect of, because in my mind, I would just never. And then like, just the challenge of, like you said, the formulas, like, was it your friend, you know, your sort of, the person who designed the formulas for the magical world of Gossamer, did he also kind of help create that sort of like theorem in the beginning of the book that's supposed to be like unsolvable?
And so he created that theorem as well. Like, we have that written down. And when I told him what it was supposed to do, so I don't remember because it was like so long ago when we worked on it, but yeah, we had long conversations and he drew it up and he said, this is how it works essentially. And so he did that form. I think those are the only two, those are the two primary formulas that show up. I think he also did the one for like how to tell time.
Okay.
But like, it's how to tell time in a world that is static, like the world's not moving.
Okay.
And so he, yeah, he did all of those.
Sure. I mean, that's amazing to me. And that's amazing to me that you would sort of, like create a story and then know that you would have to go find somebody to help you like create the theorem and be like, okay, I'm going to do that. No, I mean, that's great. I mean, that says a lot for you to be like, okay, I'm going to explore something or have something as a bit of the backbone to my story and that I don't fully necessarily understand in my own life. I mean, that says a lot. That's something very respectable in my opinion. Like, that's cool.
Thanks, Christian.
Well, you're very welcome. no, I mean, I really enjoyed this book, but you said it was originally published like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Like self-published or through another company?
No, it was still through Third World, but we did it as a hardcover.
Okay.
And so now the second book is coming out.
Okay.
And so it's been a while between books. And
sure.
So
10 years is a long while. Yeah.
Yeah. And so now that the sequel is coming out, we wanted to do more of a mass market version of it, kind of more accessible.
Okay.
Because the hardcover, like, it's a big, heavier book. It's like $20. And it's completely like, it's, we don't have any more, they're sold out. But so now that the second book is coming out, we wanted to do one that's more like, okay, kind of more in the Scholastic format that people are more accustomed to. And so like, this one is the, you know, 9x12, paperback size.
Gotcha.
And so it's like it's a lower price point. It's, it is a easier, like, you know, if you're at a convention and you're like, oh, do I want to buy my kid a $20 hardcover that they might beat the hell out of? Or am I more okay with, am I more okay with getting them this paperback? So we wanted to make it more accessible for parents and make sure that it was available now that the second book is coming out also in paperback form along with it.
Yeah.
We can, I just do it correctly because also I know that people want their books to match. Like, they don't want, like, I have the original hardcover.
Oh, gotcha.
And just like, in there will be there'll be a second edition hardcover as well.
Oh, I was just going to ask that.
For the second volume, but that one is going to be like I think a direct order. Like, we won't be doing that one through distribution. Like, you'll have to get that through the website or at conventions.
Gotcha.
That one.
Oh, so that's interesting. So you did this like 10 years ago. And so I guess my question is, when the first time it got published and between now, is that when you had your son? Because you had mentioned you don't want kids to, because that's a big thing with me, is like the gateway to getting young kids into comics these days, for me, it's a little bit of a high bar for people who are not already involved in comics, because the kid goes and grabs a pamphlet book that's maybe 20 pages, and it's like, hi, can I buy? And now it's like $5, $6, $7 for like pamphlet comics. And a lot of parents, whether you choose to believe it or not, myself included, look at that and go, I'm not paying that for that. When there's like maybe a manga that's like 300 pages, you know, and is $10, you know, or $12, right? Like maybe I'm just cheap or fiscally responsible.
Like, kids need a lot of stuff. And the scale of comics, like when we were growing up, I'm assuming like I could go to the store with $5 and come out with a handful of books.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's just not a thing anymore.
Yeah.
And so I loved buying comics for my kid. And luckily I was able to, you know, through a lot of my freelance and other things, I would accumulate comics that I could give him as well. But like we would have to like plan like how many books a month you would get, because I'd be like, I can't support all of these titles, kid. I wish I could.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, one of the things, obviously, I mean, I'm a fan of comics, right? I'm creative in my regular life and stuff like mm-hmm. that. And I wanted to introduce comics to my daughter when she was younger. And one of the big lessons was like, hey, do you want that My Little Pony book that's like $4? Or do you want the trade of My Little Pony? I've given you this much. How much are you going to get out of each one? And, you know, thankfully, my daughter was smart enough to go like, wait, this has more, you know, so right. I'm going to, or I was always like, look at the sales rack or look at, you know, I'm sure comic shop owners hate me for saying this, but like in all honesty, that's part of the equation when it comes to, you know, getting kids into comics is the parent is the hurdle, right? The parent is going to look at that and be like, this is like $6. Like this is, you're going to read this in 5 minutes and throw it in the, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's hard. And that's why one of the things I do love, and I'm glad that we got to participate in a couple of times, was Free Comic Book Day. Mm. So like Gossamer was, I think there was 3 Free Comic Book Day versions. And when we knew there was going to be a larger delay for volume 2, we stopped doing it. But like, it was huge in just getting the book into people's hands who may not have seen it.
Sure.
And possibly led to like a future purchase or other things like that. And my son is actually, he's 20.
Oh, okay.
So he's bigger now. So when Gossamer came out, he was littler.
Gotcha.
And I think he was probably around 8 years old when we first started doing the single issues. And then by the time the hardcover came out, he was 10.
Oh, okay. But so like, you're doing single issues in the beginning. I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah. That's another thing we just can't do anymore. Like that was just, we're going straight to the collected versions now.
Okay.
Just because of the timeline between like, because there was nobody else I was going to do this book with.
Yeah.
And so like Sarah and I each had different things going on in our lives that made us, you know, that required more of our time and attention. And, you know, we each have full-time jobs.
Yep.
And, you know, we're raising families and all sorts of life changes. And so I'm really glad that people still want to read the second book. And I think we're going to hopefully be able to reach a whole new audience of like, you know, 5 to 10 year olds who don't know about the book yet. And so they kind of get to rediscover it. And Sarah went through and like remastered all the pages. And so even if you have the original first book, she touched every page and she's like, you know what? There's art that I want to update. I've learned a lot in 10 years. And so nothing has changed. She just decided she wanted to pretty up the book.
Oh, and that's so smart. Very cool.
Yeah. So even if you have the first one, this one will be a little bit different. And in 10 years, I was able to be like, you know what? I can tweak some of this dialogue to make some of these bits a little clearer. I think so. The version you have, I believe, is the new version.
Yeah.
Like that's the updated one. And so I was able to, there was a few things where I'm like, oh, I wish I had made this a little more clear.
Sure.
And not like over explaining or anything, but just like, oh, okay, I can see why this part would have been confusing.
So this is like the director's cut.
Sort of. Yeah, I could say like this would be the director's cut.
The George Lucas revised director's cut, right?
Depends on how you feel about the George Lucas revised cuts. But
well, I know how I feel about it.
So we'll just say director's cut and we'll leave it there.
Sure. I know how I feel about it. I'm just going to shut my mouth now. that's how I feel about it. But we've talked a lot about like math and the involvement and sort of like, but let's talk about the world of Gossamer, because I mean, I do want people to know like, I've said it a couple of times, but this is a beautiful looking book and there's some really neat characters in there, character designs. And in the end, it's very much like a Lord of the Rings-ish sort of thing, and fun and light and sort of thing. So I just want people to understand like what they're getting into with this book, because I mean, I don't, earlier on, I mean, like we said, it's not educational, but I don't want people to think it's like some boring, dry thing, because it's not.
Thank you.
It's an adventure series.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so like for me, it was very much a kids from our world going on an adventure in a magical world and allowing them to, I guess, discover what it is about themselves that maybe in our world didn't feel special.
Yeah.
and in this world feels different. And even though it, like, obviously it's hostile in many ways, there's also parts of it that are, like, very welcoming in that just how they treat Denny and how they treat Jenna and how, like, even, like, things that Jenna took for granted, she's able to apply there. Like, she, like, her veterinary skills are a big deal there. And so just for me, it was wanting to tell essentially a sibling story. Like, that's really what it is. And then wanting to put it against a fantastical backdrop of this adventure so that, because if it was just about, like, a fantastical adventure, like, that, I don't feel, for me, I would have been able to stay interested in the story. Like, for me, it always has to be about the characters and the people and, like, the journey that they take together.
Yeah.
And so for me, no matter what is happening in the world, it is really, it always just comes back to Jenna and Denny's relationship, like, and everything kind of revolves around that for me. And so the fact that you can put that in a world where you have, like, these, like magical creatures, and you are meeting, like fantastical races, and, you know, like, swordsmen and heroes, and there's bad guys, and there's, like, cool monsters, and Sarah makes everything look amazing. Like, this essentially,
I mean, she's like great.
This blueprint for an animated, like, feature, right? Like, it's just, she did such a gorgeous job with it.
Does she work that, digitally or traditional? I mean, I imagine it's so mostly digital, right?
It is mostly digital. There's a few pages that she did by hand.
Really?
Yes. And I believe they were sold a long time ago, but there's, like, a few covers. And I think, like, the two page, like, arrival spread in Gossamer is all very, I think that was done by hand, but mostly it's all digital work.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, Sarah's been working. So the way Sarah and I met is we were both doing web comics back in the day.
Yeah.
And we were both, like, on, I forgot what, God, I can't remember the name of the website that tracked Top Web Comics. Yeah. Okay. So we were both, like, kind of on Top Web Comics. We met at San Diego Con.
Oh, nice.
And then I started working on Gossamer. Like, I had a pitch for it, but I didn't know what I wanted it to look like. And then I remembered a mutual friend said, you should ask Sarah to do it. And Sarah and I had only met one time.
Sure.
And I was like, oh my God, she would be amazing at this. Like, it would look in my head, like, exactly, like, her art would capture that. And so our friend introduced us and I sent her the pitch and she agreed to work on it. And then she started turning in designs and everything she did was actually better than I imagined it would be. When she put it to the page, like, the world is gorgeous. And I like to do a lot of world building, even if you never see it in the book.
Sure.
Like every creature has a name, it has a little bit of a backstory, every location is kind of like, this is all my, you know, game design RPG background, like, all that's written down somewhere so that I can be informed. And so, like, that's all there, and, like, the history of the world is there. But it's really there just so that when people talk, it's coming from a place of, I'm not just pulling it out of my ass.
Sure.
At the time, like, so that it is, like, grounded in, it's grounded in something.
Sure.
That was real. And so working with Sarah on that has been great. And then also there was times where I would send her, like, a script or another thing, and she'd be kind of like, I don't know. And so, like, her being one of the people, her, my wife would always read the scripts, and so she would give me a lot of, like, story editing to make sure that I was staying true to the characters. And especially since the main character is a woman and I'm not. Making sure that things feel genuine, and that, because for me, in the same way that I would go get a math expert, because I don't know math,
of course, I'm
not an expert on how a female character would react in this situation. I know how I felt in the situation, but that's not exactly the same. And so to have that kind of help from both Sarah and my wife has been invaluable throughout the process.
Sure. And what about sort of the fantasy element of it? I mean, you've mentioned role-playing games. We've talked about, I mean, there's a very sort of, like, I mean, I guess just the generic term at this point is like Dungeons and Dragons, like vibe to it, right? Or Lord of the Rings. I mean, that's pretty much what, but
that's where everybody, that's kind of where everything comes from, really.
Yeah, like, right? Like, I guess it all comes, right?
Yeah, it's Lord of the Rings, Dungeons and Dragons, and then there's just sort of evolutions and variants on those worlds.
Yeah.
And so,
well, Dungeons and Dragons let you make your own world.
Right, so that's true.
Kids, you got to play Dungeons and Dragons. That was one of, yeah, that was why I always loved Dungeons and Dragons. You could just make up your own stuff as long as you stuck to the rules, kids.
Yes.
But yeah, yeah. I mean, I imagine you were an RPG guy growing up.
I was. I loved, like, I had the red box.
Oh, yeah. The red box. Wow.
I had the red
box.
That's
old school.
Yeah. And my father was a big, like, video gamer, which was amazing. And so, like, he, like, one of the earliest games we played, like, we played Ultima on the PC, which is like a huge sprawling like RPG game. And so RPGs and systems, I've been a video game designer for over 20 years now. And so been designing and writing video games, and so like building systems and then writing story around it is pretty much what I've been doing professionally. And I was doing that even before, because originally Gossamer is based on a mini like RPG rule set I made like back in college.
Ah, that's so cool. So you made your own like little role-playing game and and then it grew out from this. Now, well, did that involve math? Like, were people having to do math at the table?
No,
because that would be kind of cool.
Back then there was, it was not math based. It was straight, like it was a straight fantasy with like four classes and other things. But like, a lot of the things that you see in the book.
Yeah.
So like you had bladeslingers as a class, and then sort of like how they evolved and became the version they are in the, in Gossamer is very different, but like that's where it started.
Yeah.
And like Harlequins were a class, a type of thief in the original RPG. And in this one, they evolved into essentially a class of assassins of the Scathe in the other, like they're a higher level. And so like all of that came from, the Tiali were part of it. And so like all of that started there. And then when I decided to work on Gossamer, I was like, oh, let me look at this book and this stuff and see if this is what I wanted. And I was like, oh, I can evolve this world that I made and turn it into the Gossamer world.
That's so cool. Like, I love how so many of us role-playing kids or whatever, like those games just provided the basis for, it's like a springboard for other things. Like, that's what so many people don't understand. Like, oh, they're just like, RPG nerds or whatever. And then how also on top of that, like at one point in our lives, like, because the one game that, I mean, I still run a group or did up until the pandemic, and I just didn't want to do it via Zoom. You know, the part of the fun is getting people in the room and having people in the room. And we were trying to play on Zoom, and it was just, I was just like, I'm in front of a computer all day, every day. This is not fun for me. You know what I mean?
No, I get it.
But I mean, like the game that we used to play was is a superhero game called Villains of Vigilantes. And
I remember that one.
Yeah. And part of that whole thing, like years ago when we were sort of building our group, like I devoted hours to like refining the rules and coming up with our own rules and our house rules. And this is the world. And I was like, man, if I could just devote this much energy to like my own stuff, like what is it that possesses us to just, once we get into an RPG sort of thing, we just become so passionate about it and either want to create our own games or just take the games that we have and just like expand upon them and make them better in our own eyes. Not that Villains Vigilantes isn't good. It is good. Shut up about it. I don't want to hear about it. It's a great game. But I'm just saying, like, isn't that interesting? Like how stuff like that fosters creativity?
Yes. I cannot encourage like people to play these games enough
just
because of like, it's that kind of like storytelling and kind of that group experience and the, that want to be creative and contribute to a world and create things, like that's a feeling that like very few things can give you.
Yeah.
It's why like, you know, like in, if you look at the video game space, like that's like Minecraft, like just the idea of like creating your own world and building those things, like there is a certain just like there's a draw to that. And there's like something that pulls you in when you are given pieces that you want to make it your own and you want to define it and you want to like shape it to be more yours so that you are telling your stories. And I'm not sure why for some people that becomes their whole life. Like they're like, I'm going to do this all the time.
Yeah.
For some people like that's enough, but I just think it is a very cool experience. And I'm really, really glad that I got to find people when I was young. Cause when I first found the Red Box, like nobody, I didn't know enough people. So I just played the solo adventure.
And then
read like the Lone Wolf books that were kind of like, you could play the book sort of thing. And
so
choose your own adventure, like those things. And so when I got to high school is when I started finding people who actually played the game and then got into a campaign. And
yeah,
like there's something special about that long running adventure that you're like creating with your friends. Like it's just, there's nothing else that really replicates that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I everyone should go do it for a little while.
Yeah.
And now, I'm glad it's much cooler now.
I mean, it's funny because there are apparently like Dungeons and Dragons clubs, like there was one in middle school and then the pandemic happened. And I keep telling my daughter, I'm like, go, like, just try it. I don't know, you know, whatever. And I'm like, it will be, you know, I mean, it's funny because it involves aspects of like creativity. And then there's like this weird gambling rush without the gambling, you know, the dangers of gambling involved, because you're like, I rolled a 20 or whatever, you know what I mean? And then the whole room just like erupts and you're like, oh, double damage or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
It's just like so much fun. And I can see how that would, I mean, it's just so interesting to me over the years running into, you know, interviewing people for this podcast and just at conventions and stuff, you just run into people and it's like, oh man, I used to love that stuff. And it was so much fun, and how much it just fosters this, like, you know, respect for, or want for creativity. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, amazing. I totally agree.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's the sort of thing that just spills through this book, you know, Finding Gossamer. I mean, it seems firmly rooted in those fantasy elements. I mean, I'm not off, but the one thing I wanted to compliment you on is, what are the magicians? I can't find the phrase right. I was trying to scroll through the emails and stuff. There's a different name for the magicians in your world. They're like, what is it?
Arithmancers.
Arithmancers. That's so cool. Like, I just thought that was very smart and well put together. I mean,
thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I do really like this book. I love the concepts behind it. I love that it's not like, you know, like an educational book, but there's a basis for, like, you know, getting kids maybe or people, you know, like me, interested in math or something that they may not have been interested in before. So, I mean, this edition, the first volume is coming out, right? March 23rd, correct?
That is the scheduled date.
The scheduled date. Yeah. Well, the paper crisis and all that kind of like throws things. But that's the scheduled date. And when is volume 2 scheduled then?
So volume 2, which is called Breaking Gossamer.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Should be out in probably this summer. Is the targeted date. So like the book is all finished. I'm actually working on volume 3 right now, which will probably complete the series as far as that goes. That'll be a trilogy.
So there's not going to be a 10-year wait between 2 and 3.
No, that is not the plan.
Good.
Sarah and I have talked about it. And so the goal is that we're able to kind of, she's working on another project right now that is really awesome. That is on Webtoons.
Oh, cool.
And let me make sure I get the right name.
Sure.
For it. But she's working on that right now, and she's been very prolific with her pages and going very like quickly with the storytelling. It's called Immaterial.
Oh, okay. I'm going to look that up.
And it's gorgeous. And I will let you look up what the story is about, but I would highly recommend checking out that if you are enjoying her work on Finding Gossamer.
Yeah, no, it looks beautiful. So David A. Rodriguez, do you have anything final you'd like to wrap up with? Anything you want to say? Where can people find you? Where can people, I mean, does it have its own dedicated website? Tell the people how to get in touch with you.
Okay. Well, So Finding Gossamer does have, I believe they have like, there's like a Facebook page, but the easiest way to keep track of it is going on the Third World Studios website or their Facebook page for any updates.
Gotcha.
So that is the easiest way to follow what is going to happen with the book. I'm on Twitter. I don't really have a lot of super interesting things to say on there, but I will post things about, you'll hear some things about some games and some things about books and other projects that I'm working on as they come out.
Sure.
Is probably the best way. And then, you know, if you're ever at a convention, I love Gen Con. It's my favorite show of the year.
I've never been.
And it is highly worth it, especially since you like all the RPG stuff. It is one of my favorite shows, but also PAX Unplugged in Philly, which is at the end of the year, is also a great show, depending on which part of the country you're in. I don't usually do gaming shows out in, or comic shows out in California. I haven't done San Diego in several years.
Yeah, well, it's packed.
Obviously, yes, yeah. There are many, many people there, but yeah. That's another way to, I love meeting readers and talking to people in person as well.
So I'm sure people, like whenever you go to a convention, they can just look you up on Twitter.
Yeah, you can find that. And there's usually a page for that.
What's your direct Twitter handle? Do you remember?
I believe it is at Dave A. Rodriguez. Nice. Is my
awesome
Twitter, but I'm going to double check now because I
had it right in front of me. But yeah, let's looking at where it. Am I? Yeah, it's at Dave A. Rodriguez with a Z.
Yes, with a Z. That is me.
With a Z. And I should say that the Third World Studios website, it looks like it's thirdworld.com, but the I is replaced by a 3. So yes. It's th3rdworld.com. So that's where you can find more information about Finding Gossamer. Yeah, I mean, I cannot say enough positive things about this book. It's beautiful. It's unique. It's, you know, gorgeous to look at, a very fun read, not enough superlatives. I really appreciate you taking the time to come onto this podcast and just sharing it with me because, in all honesty, I was not aware of it. And it is definitely something that, you know, I'm going to have to hunt down the first volume, the second volume when it comes out. And yeah, I think everyone should check this out because especially if you're into stuff like Bone or Amulet or Lord of the Rings or, you know, this book will be right up your mathematician alley. But you don't need to know math. We should
don't. There's very low math barrier of entry. So.
Very little math. But all right. I mean, final words. David?
My final words are I'm really glad that the book is coming back out. Gossamer is probably the book that is closest to my heart in anything that I've ever worked on in the last, you know, like my professional career, the last 20 years. It is, I think it's important for a lot of ways, and I'm glad that so many people still want to read it. And mm-hmm. So I appreciate everybody being patient as we've been working on the second volume. But yeah, I'm just really glad it's coming back out. I love the characters and I love working in this world. And I just want to thank you for having me on the show, Christian. I really appreciate it. Thank Melissa for setting this up.
That's right.
And again, a thank you to, Sarah for being an awesome collaborator and to my wife, Jessica, for making sure that, I got the story told right.
Yeah. And that's Melissa at Don't Hide PR. So
correct.
Yeah, she's great. She's great. I love working with her.
Me too,
year or so. But yeah, well, my name is Christian Horn, and this has been the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. Check out Finding Gossamer when it's, comic shops, bookstores, right? Everywhere.
Yep. Should be available. It's available through, I believe, Simon & Schuster is distributing. So it should be anywhere.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's sold. A big deal. You're the big deal. What are you doing on my podcast? No, I'm just kidding. Anyway, this has been the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. My name is Christian Horn. You can check us out on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. All that wonderful social media stuff that I've come to loathe. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Check out Finding Gossamer. You will love it. I guarantee it. I mean, I'm not going to give you your money back or anything, but I guarantee that you're going to love it. I mean, it's a fun book. And as always, thank you for listening. And we will be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Bye. Thanks, Christian.
part-time fanboy.